Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, February 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum. We welcome back our brilliant scientists to the show to field all of your inquiries. The lines are now open, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Always good to check in early on this program, and you can also email, if you wish, voxpopwamc.org, voxpopwamc.org, or call. It's a good thing. It's a call-in show, 800-348-2551. Yeah, the Science Forum is here, and we will convene said Science Forum right after the news. Oh, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and we've gathered just brilliant people here into the studio. I'm in awe, literally in awe here. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. But we love the calls here, 800-348-2551. Get in line now, and let's meet our panel of experts.
Hey, it's Barbara Brabetz. I'm from SUNY Cobleskill, and I am a biochemist.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
We missed you last time.
We had Dr. Michael Murphy in my place for a while there.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, and I'm sort of mostly retired.
Okay.
Ed Stander from SUNY Cobleskill, geology, astronomy, anything Barbara can't answer. And I want to mention that the reason we're so brilliant is the lights. The lighting in this room is incredibly bright.
You're right. LED lights, you know.
Yeah.
Lighting for radio.
So I understand, Jim, helium has been a naughty element.
Yeah, helium is the last of the so-called inert gases that had not done any chemistry. Mm-hmm. And in our latest edition of Chemical and Engineering News, there was the news that under the pressure of about 1 million atmospheres, mm-hmm. helium could react with sodium to make a compound that stuck around at the very high pressure. They got a crystal structure. It's a pretty cool crystal structure. But was the last of there are no more inert gases.
What does that mean for us as a practical matter?
Absolutely nothing.
Ah,
but it was sort of a, you know, there on the right-hand side of the periodic table in the olden days.
All alone.
It used to say inert gases. And then it kind of changed to noble gases because they were standoffish.
Very noble.
And kind of from the bottom up, chemistry has been found for each one of them, starting with xenon. And helium was the last to...
The holdout.
The holdout.
Well, that's exciting news.
Well, if you're a helium, your world is shaken.
if you're a helium. All right, well.
At 1 million bar.
That's right. Yes.
What do you say we go to the phones, kids? 800-348-2551. Robert in Kinderhook. Robert, you're on.
Hello. So I'm the first one. Okay. I'm a paleontologist. I got my training at Stony Brook University in the 70s and got my degree there. And I worked on a small bryozoan Prasopora from the Ordovician period. During that period of time in our Earth, there was no effective protective atmosphere for life outside of the oceans. I know we've sent many missions to Mars, and they've found abundant proof of water, substantial amount of water up there, at least in the past. I'm wondering, are there any plans to send a mission to sample that and bring it back to Earth so someone like a paleontologist, myself, could study and see if there are any fossils?
Barbara.
Are you voting, Robert? Are you want in?
I'm a little beyond that age now. I'm close to 70. I would love the idea, but I could never survive a trip there. So it had to be brought back here to Earth so I could study it.
We could just, like, shoot photos back. One of the things is, you're right, there is a lot of water on Mars. We found it tied up in the rocks, as you talk about, as hydrates. We've also found it as frozen water in places, pockets that are really cold and where it's protected and it doesn't evaporate or sublime. So your assumptions are correct. We also know that there were seas at one point in time, way, way back in its history. So I think your question is, was there enough time that Mars was covered with liquid water for us to develop organized life that could be seen as a fossil? And is there enough impetus to go and check for that? So I think we're taking real baby steps with Mars, unless you talk to Elon Musk, I guess. But but we went to look for rock and water. We're kind of looking for life, but really by inference right now. We're looking for changes that could have been brought around because of life. And then I think what we're also looking at in the future is things like oxygen. Is there atmospheric oxygen around? That's another big one.
Was there not a brouhaha several years ago about a meteorite that may or may not have had a microbial fossil?
Yeah, it landed, I think it was in Antarctica, wasn't it, Ed?
Yeah, it was in Antarctica.
If I could just say something here. The fossils that I studied were from the Ordovician, mm-hmm. and that was a period of time where there was no protective oxygen over the Earth. Mm-hmm. Nothing was living on land. Everything was in the ocean. So I don't think that fact that a search for a lengthy time of an atmosphere that would protect life on land would necessarily negate the fact there could not be life in the water. And then there's not only life in the water as we know now, but there was way back when in very primitive stages of the planet Earth when there was no atmosphere.
I think Ed wants to jump in here.
Well, yeah, I can give you two things. First of all, there was probably free oxygen in the atmosphere from about 1.5 billion years ago. And we know that from the study of banded ironstones and the formation of things like uraninite on the surface, which stopped being existing when the oxygen first got to the surface. So there was certainly oxygen in the atmosphere, but my problem with Mars is more on the basis of the fact that Mars has no magnetosphere, which it means it has almost no protection from solar input. It has no ozone, which again, no ozone layer, which means that you're going to have a lot of ultraviolet coming in, which means that anything in the small pockets would probably be destroyed before it ever got a chance to really take off.
And then another piece that I wanted to say is that, and I think I didn't do it well enough, was there may not have been enough time, even with those constraints, to have liquid water there as a protective soup to actually foster life. You need time, and that's what you didn't have on Mars.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know when the oceans actually disappeared,
right?
But they were probably there for a billion years or more.
But it took us a billion to get our act together here, and we're hotter and bigger and more protected.
But at 2 billion, we at least had bacteria starting to take off.
Right.
But I think part of the question, too, is there a sample return mission planned? sample return missions have certainly been talked about, but I don't think there's one on the books yet.
Expensive, right?
Yeah, expensive because it's a two-way trip instead of a one-way trip.
Regarding the lack of a magnetic field, is that something that waned over time? Have they checked rocks for presence of magnetic field way back when?
No, they haven't. But on the other hand, there's no evidence that we can see a magnetosphere on Mars, and that's mostly because if it does have a core, because Mars is so much smaller than we are, it's probably frozen shut.
That's my point. What I'm saying is, you can check magnetic lines of polarity or whatever they call it by looking at lava. Can they do the same thing and see if the strength of a magnetic field, say, a billion years ago?
Well, there's one small area of Mars that shows magnetic banding, and we've measured that.
Mm.
And some people have suggested that at one point or another there may have been plate tectonics on Mars, because we see the same thing on Earth in areas where the ocean's opening up. But nobody's been able to explain that because there's pretty not much obvious evidence of plate tectonics besides that.
And wouldn't you also need more than one site to really have perspective as to what one side of the planet is doing versus the other?
Well, we've mapped Mars actually better than we've mapped the Earth.
Mm.
And we have information about its magnetic signature, amongst other things.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop, 800-348-2551, the number. Barbara in Malta. Barbara, you're on.
Hi. I just have a really fast and kind of silly question. I like to keep a spray bottle of Clorox and water solution to spray down counters and the sink and wipe it up and everything else. And, you know, I go through so many water bottles because somehow that Clorox and water solution seems to clog up the spray bottle. And I'm not sure why. Does it form a salt or something? Or is there something about Clorox that just clogs things.
It's going to be pretty corrosive on things that are metal. So if there's metal components like a spring in there, that could be corroded and make little chunks of stuff that clog up your spray.
And right up at the tip, too, what you do to make bleach is you take sodium hypochlorite, which is it's hypochlorite, which means it's got oxygen and chlorine. That's why they call it Clorox. It's like the most non-imaginative brand name ever. it takes sodium hypochlorite and you dissolve it in water. And it's about a 5% solution is what you buy in the big bottle for 99 cents at the store. Are you making your own from bleach? Are you making it from a commercial cleaner? Are you cutting down the concentration?
I'm just taking some Clorox and putting it in the plastic bottle, and then I'm adding water. I'm not sure what the concentration is, but I've been trying to make it weaker and seeing if that will help. But, you know, it's always about a month or so later that I can't spray anymore. It just gives out. And I was wondering.
You know, what you might want to do is buy a spray bottle of one of the cleaners with bleach.
Okay.
Because if it's a matter of metal corrosion, they may have designed the nozzle in a way where there's not metal exposed.
Right.
And then just do what you're doing after you use that up.
But don't buy one that has ammonia.
No. Just the chlorine ones.
The chlorine ones, that may be enough different than that you can reuse the bottle with your homemade solution.
And one other tip for the homeowners, too, is that if you're going to put it in a different bottle, again, no ammonia ever because they react and you can die.
Yeah.
The other thing is that you don't want it, you need it to be an opaque bottle. It should not be clear because the sunlight, just regular ambient light, will actually decompose it quicker and make it pretty much useless.
Okay, Barbara, that's great. Thank you for that. We'll take a break here. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York. Working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades. ShannonRose.com. Curtis Lumber, featuring Great American Kitchen, Wellborn Cabinets, and Cambria Quartz Countertops. 100% American-made products by American workers. Sold locally by Curtis Lumber, CurtisLumber.com. Schenectady County Historical Society, in the historic stockade and at Mabee Farm Historic Site, presenting winter basket weaving workshops, speaker series, kids programs, and more, SchenectadyHistorical.org. And Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, RealSeafoodCO.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum. Ray Graff here, and what a great panel of scientists we have.
For
Barbara Brabitz, Jim Pickett, Ed Stander here, and you at home, 800-348-2551. We go to Mark in Averill Park. Mark.
Yeah, I was listening earlier, and I heard Judith Inc. Say that 97% of scientists agree that climate change is real, and I thought she said caused by man. And I'm just curious, you guys are scientists. What do you think of that? Do you agree with that? And I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say about that.
Thanks. Thank you. All right.
Well, it's hard to get 95% of us when there's only three in the room, but can't do the math. But I agree with Judith Inc.
Yep, and I do too. She's 100% right.
Ed, you're the swing vote.
The polar bears are fine. No.
Right. Michael in Clifton Park. Michael, you're on.
Hi, everybody. Two questions, probably naive. The first one is the moon on the backside is dark, black, very, very cold. On this side of the moon that we see, it's very, very hot. So theoretically, is there a place where the shade and the light meet that it could be room temperature?
Yeah, probably at the north or south pole if you're at the right spot in the crater, because the moon doesn't have much of a tilt, and so you can actually
right.
find a spot where it would work out. The other place, of course, would be the terminator, because one side isn't always cold and one side isn't always hot. It actually rotates as it goes around the Earth. It takes one rotation for one revolution. So that spot rotates every 29 days. It goes around the moon twice, effectively.
And what's the terminator?
The terminator is the line between light and dark. So certainly any place, if you wanted to be there. I remember reading a science fiction story years ago where a person was marooned on one of these planets, and the only way he could survive was by walking around the planet once a year, because the terminator would move a little bit every day.
Huh. Well, there you go. You have a follow-up, Michael?
Yes, the universe, the Big Bang, it bangs, and then the universe is moving outward like a balloon. So you've got one side that is where the universe is expanding into, and then you've got the actual matter of the universe expanding out. So if I get out to that very, very edge and I look one direction, I'm going to see, I would see all black. And if I turn around 180 degrees, would I not see the stars?
Well,
coming toward me?
Yeah, the problem is that you can't visualize the Big Bang like that, because the universe means everything. And the Big Bang occurred everywhere in the universe all at the same time. So it is the universe itself that's expanding. There's no edge to it. Now, you can kind of get around this problem by saying that it's expanding into a fourth spatial dimension. But that's really a nonsense answer, because
okay.
we can't imagine that. But the deal is that there is no edge to
the space
to the
itself
universe.
Is what is expanding?
Space itself.
Everything was in that pinpoint?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you can't visualize it like, You're sitting off and watching this glowing ball expand. There's literally no place to stand to do that.
I see that.
It's everywhere. The analogy that a way to visualize this is to shrink everything by one dimension. So instead of a three-dimensional world, you think about a two-dimensional world. In that two-dimensional world, the universe is portrayed as being like the skin of a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
And then the universe expand. If you are a two-dimensional creature on that two-dimensional surface, you would see everything expanding, but there not being an edge anywhere. It's just getting bigger.
Mm.
Now, in that case, you say, well, it's expanding into a third dimension. We're out looking at that. So you can do kind of that analogy with saying that, well, our three-dimensional space is growing into a fourth dimension, but that doesn't really have any information value to that, but it's a way to visualize it.
And the shorthand is we call the visible universe diameter. That's what we kind of say, is that where we can see from the bleachers that don't exist off in the distance, that diameter is about 100 billion light years, just a hair under 100 billion light years across.
Yeah. And you can imagine that back into the two-dimensional analogy, that if you were a two-dimensional creature on the surface of that balloon, you could draw a circle around a point saying that that's the distance at which light has been able to travel.
Mm.
And then, of course, that circle grows with time because light's coming from further and further away,
mm-hmm.
but the balloon's also getting bigger. So it's stretching that out.
Hard to do on the radio.
Yeah, this is what we call on the astronomy show the lava lamp moment. We fire up the lava lamp, and then we get real esoteric. Let's go to Patrick in LaGrangeville. Patrick.
Oh, I'm going to digest something much simpler.
Splendid.
Were we just talking about spray bottles and their longevity? Is that something that came in and somebody talking about the percentage of bleach in the solution?
Yes.
I think so.
Yep.
Okay. So anyway, having used many spray bottles, I mean, I think they're just made cheaply, so no matter what you put through them, they're not going to last. Unless you're putting solvents in there, and then of course it's a different story. So anyway, that point being made is that there are two different types of spray bottles, right? There's the one that has the the siphon that goes all the way down to the bottom of the bottle, and there are the new ones now where the tube is much shorter, and it seems that there is a, how does that work? I guess my question is, how does that work with that one with the little tube? It certainly doesn't reach down to the bottom of the barrel there to suck up the solution. So I guess that's the question.
Okay.
Well, that really has to do with application. So the new ones that kind of have it off to the side, or they have a short one at the top, are meant for when you invert the substance. So the reason why we have the straw that goes to the bottom of the container of bleach is because we hold it upright and we fire it like a gun at whatever germ we're trying to kill. And so it's upright. If we were to turn it upside down or aim at the floor, that stuff is going to slosh because of gravity. So they've made the new straws to stop the irritation of us homeowners, where you just have a little bit left in the bottom, but you can't get it because you're tilting the bottle and it's not going where it's supposed to go. So they've decided to make a new and improved bottle that has that siphon off to the side.
Patrick, thank you so much. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Marcia in Del Mar. Marcia, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Not to belabor this, but...
Can you get off speakerphone? Would it be possible?
No, I'm not, but here, I can improve this. I know I'm not in a...
Oh, speaker. You're much better now. Okay, go ahead.
Is this better?
Yep.
Okay. I used to make up a Clorox solution. It was 50-50 in a plastic bottle and spray it around, and the bottle would fail. And then I tried buying one bottle of the commercially made stuff, and I thought, well, their bottles are going to work. Nope, it failed. So what I did then was, after every use, and this is tedious, but after every use, I rinsed out the straw that goes to the bottom and rinsed out the squirter thing. Ran clear water through the squirter thing, and the bottle lasted indefinitely.
Yeah, because that's where we think it's going to fail.
Yep.
Good.
Marcia,
good point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call very much. 800-348-2551, the number on the Science Forum. Irene in Chesterfield, Mass. Irene.
Hi, it's Eileen, but thanks for taking my call.
I'm calling Eileen.
Gotcha. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a planetary geologist.
Ah.
I just happen to be. And I just want to say a couple things about water on Mars and magnetics on Mars. First of all, there's quite a bit of proof that there's a lot of water on Mars.
Right.
We have a fairly substantial polar ice cap at the South Pole, and actually vapor transfers that ice from the South Pole to the North Pole during the different seasons. So it's actually molten water through the atmosphere. And there's a lot of evidence for running water on the surface of Mars in the past. The other thing is that there are the magnetic anomalies on Mars, and these are paleomagnetic anomalies.
Right.
And they are bigger than anything that has ever been seen on Earth.
Correct.
And there is no proof of plate tectonics, but I'm not sure proof of plate tectonics has a lot to do with life, because most planets have different methods of cooling themselves. So anyway, I just wanted to say that I agree with the caller that there's very possibly that they may find some sort of small fossils of life on Mars, because there was water.
Would you be willing to go?
With water. I agree. I'm too old as well.
Oh, come on.
I would have liked to when I was younger.
Make it a one-way trip.
Yeah.
Well, Eileen,
thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 800-348-2551. Kathy, if that is your name, in Poughkeepsie. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. My question has to do with disinfecting. I've switched from bleach to vinegar for a long time now because I've read that vinegar has pretty good disinfecting properties. Is that true?
It's pretty good. How's that? Pretty good? I won't say it's a... bleach is a better disinfectant generally. Yeah. But bleach has issues.
I guess the follow-up question then is, do we really need bleach in our homes? Because that's the other thing that I think I've learned, is that we really don't need to be disinfecting our homes to the extent that we do.
Oh, boy. The pH of vinegar is less than it is of stomach acid, okay? Or as it's not as acidic as stomach acid. Your stomach acid is more acidic than vinegar, certainly the stuff that you buy in the commercial bottle. And with that, what you're doing when you're putting vinegar on a surface is you're hoping that that acidity is going to break your cells apart, that the cells will just not, the cells that cause disease, bacteria, whatever, is that it'll be enough of a pH change to make them rendered ineffective. As we know, there are cells that can adapt to an acidic environment. And we do have pathogenic cells that can adapt to an acidic environment. It's really hard to survive that hungry oxygen that Jim talked about in the Clorox that's ready to go out and do the attacking. And usually pathogens really dislike oxygen in general. So that's why Clorox is really a better disinfectant than vinegar.
What about Kathy's second part of her question? Are we disinfecting and making too much antibacterial
Antibacterial is a different thing altogether. I'm not a fan of triclosan, which is the active ingredient that makes something antibacterial. First off, there's lots of proof, decades worth of proof, that triclosan doesn't disinfect any better than other than hand washing, for example. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is that it does seem to have an environmental toxic effect on the larger environment. So there's negatives about triclosan for sure. Clorox is short acting. So that's the thing. It doesn't persist in the environment. And the reason why is that oxygen is super reactive.
Okay.
Jim, did you want to add something?
No, just that, in another class that's commonly used are called the quaternary ammonium salts. And those sort of work too, but those you don't want around persisting in the environment either.
Right.
Okay, it's the Science Forum on WAMC, 800-348-2551. We go to Dave, who is on I-84 in Connecticut. Dave, you're on.
Good afternoon. Enjoying the show, and just wanted to reference the caller who said 98% of scientists believe that climate change is real. I guess I can agree with that because climate change happens all the time. I'm out here on the big road, and I see it all the time.
Yeah.
But my question is, NASA's Global Initiative for Scientific Study recently announced that it learned that the climate data has been manipulated for years in the past in order to give more credence to the global warming theory. What do you think about that?
I think that's wrong. That's not... I've read nothing that would suggest that. If anything, the data for climate warming has been strengthened with time rather than being called into question.
Having said that, the question is not necessarily that climate change is occurring, but whether it's anthropomorphic, whether it's human caused. And in that respect, I think a lot of data has been given out which suggests that it's much more human caused than it may actually be.
See, it's about the data and the interpretation. I think the data is pure as science can make it. The interpretation really is where the debate, the minuscule debate happens. And it's always an interpretation. We as scientists really enjoy the debate about interpretation. We have to figure out what it means in the larger picture. And as Neil deGrasse Tyson's t-shirt says, climate change doesn't care what you think. It's going to do what it does. What we really want to do is prepare for the future.
Let's go over to Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
Hi. I'm glad I got two chemists. I got a piece of slag that came out of my fireplace.
All right.
I burn wood, and sometimes I let the ashes just build up. But every once in a while, I'll get a piece of slag that has white crystals coming out of it.
Yeah.
What is that? I mean, they're crystals. They're just like little pieces of, they're falling apart as I'm holding it
and
right
now.
And
is this a fireplace or is it a wood stove?
Fireplace. It's just a regular fireplace, and I'm burning just only sugar maple right now.
Only sugar maple.
And what's the inside of your fireplace lined with? Is it
brick?
Okay.
Yeah.
Are they bricks that you you have to replace them every once in a while? So they're refractory brick?
No, I've never replaced them, and they're probably 100 years old.
Huh.
Well,
or at least, yeah, about that.
My first guess when you started talking was that you're getting refractory brick that's kind of reconstituted in the bottom of your fire pit. But it's hard to think that if it's 100 years old that it wouldn't have done whatever it's going to do already.
Hmm. Jim?
Yeah, but this only happens when I leave the ashes in too long. I get a whole pile of ashes, and then I'm building a fire on top of the ashes, and then I get this hunks of slag, and then every once in a while I'll get these white crystals that form out of the slag. Sometimes I've actually had some that are colored turquoise, the light blue.
Huh.
But they're not in a crystal form. They're in a flat form. Yeah. But the one I'm looking at right now is all white crystal that are
let me try a hypothesis here. That being that there's all sorts. The ash is basically minerals. It's inorganic compounds in there. If you carry in some water with the wood, like snow or the wet wood, it's possible you can extract some of that, the soluble stuff, out of some of the ash, and then it evaporates when you burn. In the process of the evaporation, then the inorganic compounds will crystallize. We'll make little crystals. If you do that repeatedly, then the crystals could grow.
Huh.
But it would be a matter of having, I think you would, for that to happen, you would have to have some liquid water being present for a little while at least.
That's why I was asking about the wood stove. But I'm thinking if you have a fireplace without a damper, it could actually come down the chimney, the water could, from rain.
Didn't they used to make lye, for example?
Yes. Exactly.
Some of the wood would be a little on the damp wet side anyway, because it's coming in from outside. I'm not keeping my wood dry.
Yeah.
My guess, not being a chemist, would be that the water coming in is interacting with the ashes to produce
the potash,
a lye,
to
produce a potash.
Yep.
Right.
And it's that's crystallizing out to produce your little crystals.
But it would have to be rather cool, because otherwise the water would be driven off by the heat of combustion.
It would be happening between fires.
So it'd have to be between fires.
That's a great question, Merle. We appreciate it. We'll take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It is the Science Forum. You are listening to WAMC, and we will be right back.
Support comes from the University at Albany Theater Program, working to train the next generation of performers, designers, technicians, playwrights, and stage managers. albany.edu/theater. The Whistling Kettle for the cold season, offering organic wellness teas such as Feel Better, Throat Therapy, Tummy Tonic, and more. Troy and Boston Spa, thewhistlingkettle.com. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive kiosks, and commercial casework for special events, museum installations, and trade shows. EmpireExhibits.com. Fort Hill Auto Body, Amherst, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated since 1997, providing auto body repair, detailing, painting, and glass replacement. A proud supporter of public radio. FortHillAutoBody.com. And the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang.
It's Fox Pop on WAMC. The Science Forum, Ray Graff here, along with Barbara Brabich, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, and you at home via the phone at 800-348-2551 or via email at voxpopwamc.org. This one came in from Joe. The bleach and water mix is nice, but the chlorine decays the seals and stops the pumping action. Mm-hmm. Haven't found a chlorine-proof sprayer, but would love to. Same happens with laundry detergent diluted to pre-spray clothing. Yeah?
True. Yes.
Okay. This one from Mary. Oh, more about the chlorine. Don't chlorine bleach molecules damage the ozone layer when the bleach evaporates? I, too, have been using vinegar instead of chlorine bleach for decades for that reason. Am I being compulsive? That's from Mary.
Go ahead, Jim.
No, it will not affect the ozone layer.
No. It doesn't make chlorine gas. It makes chloride.
Yeah, and even chlorine gas wouldn't affect.
That's right.
The ozone layer because the stuff that affects the ozone layer has to be chlorinated molecules or that are very stable and that have a long enough lifetime to reach the stratosphere.
All right.
Usually like dry cleaning fluid.
Right. Yeah.
And this one from Mark. High blood pressure is called the silent killer. So if high blood pressure is a bad thing, then why is exercise recommended to those of us with high blood pressure? Shouldn't we relax and take it easy instead as much as we can?
Well, relaxation is good.
You betcha.
But the good news about exercise is if we raise our heart rate into that target heart rate. And don't die, right? And we survive it. And what we do is the same thing that we do if we run on a treadmill, even if our heart rate doesn't go up. We do micro tears in our muscle fibers, which then our body repairs and makes stronger. So that happens to my leg muscles when I run on a treadmill. That also happens to my heart muscles when I undergo aerobic exercise and don't die. So what I'm doing is I'm making a better muscle so that in between the bouts of exercise, I have to work less to do the squeezing. So that's why exercise is good for someone with high blood pressure, because it will relieve the high blood pressure in times of rest.
All right, Mark. So, you know, get off the couch, do a little something.
Don't die.
Don't die, though. That's right. That's the whole key to the exercise program. Mike in Rexford is on. Mike.
Yes, hi. Great show. First, I have a question about, it's more of a technology than science question. It's about the LED light bulbs that we're using. But first, a few callers ago, there was a guy talking about global warming, and I'm familiar with that. There's actually a story out there. It was a discussion that some scientists at NAOO were having about data storage, and it was the storage of their intermediate calculations, not the data, but their work and how it should be archived. Pretty much one guy was mad that they weren't using his method, but the right-wing media got a hold of this and distorted the story to make it seem like they were manipulating the data, but it was really a totally different issue.
So it was more about a turf war about who had what data where?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The guy was mad they weren't doing it his way.
Yeah.
Okay. Angry scientist.
That sounds about like science, really. Yeah.
All right, Mike, what about the LED bulbs?
We're using these LED bulbs. They're supposed to last like 20 or 30 years. And I'm wondering, like, how are they going to fail? Because I have a bunch of LEDs, like in old devices, DVD players and such, and the displays are getting dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, and that's kind of what they do. So is it going to be that, like, these LED light bulbs that we all have, are they just going to slowly get dimmer, and we'll all eventually get kind of disgusted and throw it out because it's not very bright anymore? Or is it going to like just fail, like the electronics in it are going to fail? You know, like a conventional light bulb either works or doesn't. And are the LEDs going to kind of slowly fade away until we get tired of them and throw them away or something?
Yeah.
Anyone know?
I think that, yes, you have the two failure modes. The electronics could fail, in which case then it doesn't work. Or if the electronics are robust, then it just fades away.
Over a very long time.
Right, and after your cataract surgery and you come home and you realize your lights are still dim, then you know it's time to get a new LED bulb. Uh-huh.
Right, but the biggest
problem... they may just fail, slowly get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer and after a long time. That might be what happens.
The big problem with LEDs is that they still produce a lot of heat.
Yeah.
And they actually, the electronics have a hard time dealing with that. So, for example, LEDs put into cans on the ceiling are going to fail much faster. So I think we're going to get better at that.
Yeah.
And that's really one of the major problems with them.
And I've had problems with transformers failing on my LEDs. So there's that little thing in the back that steps down the electricity because you don't need full voltage. And that's where it seems to fail on mine.
Yeah.
On our kitchen light, we had a fluorescent for a long time and it finally gave out. And I found an LED replacement that uses the same ballast. You just basically plug and play.
Nice.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. And that shows you how boring my life really is. I'm excited about the kitchen light.
Better than plumbing.
Christopher and Troy. Christopher, you're on.
Yes, thank you. Following up on the question regarding space outside of our universe, There's talk, theories about multiple universes, multiple dimensions, I understand. And if you could please address, in those theories, is that like three-dimensional space outside of our universe? And does that interact with our universe?
Okay. You want to stay on the line, Christopher, or do you want...
Ed, I don't think wants to take
I'm
this.
I'm sitting here and saying, 11-dimensional space.
Yeah. You can, kind of by definition, the universe is everything that is, that can affect us in any way. So speculation about things outside of our universe is just that. It's speculation. There's speculation about, some physicists have some kind of inner need to explain why gravity is such a weak force. And you can explain that by saying, there's another universe that's right next to ours, and the gravity leaks out. But that's just idle speculation. There's to explain what needs to be explained. There's been no pressing need to invoke more than our three spatial dimensions.
But yet they do. You have string theory and all and all the rest.
Yet they do with string theory. And when they have some experimental proof, then we can...
And how would you go about falsifying that or whatever they call that in science? Where,
not falsifying.
Proving or testing.
That's a real good question. There have not been experiments designed yet that can test that hypothesis.
In any science, there's always the start where somebody comes up with a hypothesis, and then based on the hypothesis, they try to project what the possibilities are, and then they look for data to support that. And we're in the data support phase. We really can't say what's going on because we don't have the information to be able to deny or say that it's possible.
Fair enough. Our number here is 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. Colin in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Colin.
Hi. I was wondering, we know that there are other planets in which we are able to inhabit, however far away. I'm curious if there's a possibility that those planets can support or have supported life very similar to ours. Basically, if there are extraterrestrials on these planets already, what are the chances of them being very similar to humans in the sense that we evolved from apes? And the follow-up question is, do we have the ability to kind of age those planets to see possibly how far along, they've had life or ecosystem very similar to Earth?
Well, there's a formula floating out there called the Drake Equation.
Been out there since 1960, right?
Yeah, about that. And the Drake Equation effectively is a whole series of things. What if, what if, what if? What if the sun is around long enough to produce life? What if there's a planet in what's called the Goldilocks zone? What if there is a person on that planet who actually can come up with a way of communicating with us? And you combine all of those things, none of which we actually have numbers for. And we can come up with a number, which doesn't mean anything. And effectively, that is our problem. So we have the SETI program. We have other programs out there trying to find communications. But outside of that, we know that there are planets out there that were conducive to life. I mean, they just announced yesterday that there are 9 planets around this one star, 4 of which are within the Goldilocks zone and could very well have the precursors or the things, reason for life. But even in the Drake Equation, it ends by saying we have something out there that can communicate with us. It doesn't even go further than that to say that it's got to be human or humanoid.
Right.
And if you get to that point, then you've got n to the x power, and it's impossible to say what the possibilities are.
So Galaxy Quest, one of my favorite sci-fi movies.
Oh,
I'm not going to do any impressions. The intelligent life was more of a cephalopod. So if you look at our planet as to who the intelligent divergent species are, they're all vertebrates. So we all have a backbone. But you've got, not lobsters. Those are the dumb ones. Octopus and squid that seem to have intelligence that rivals a small child.
Really?
Okay. Yes, they've done IQ tests. I mean, people develop IQ tests for squids. They really do. Anyway,
wow.
They give them
She's
mazes.
Not squidding.
Yeah, nice. They give them mazes and they make them more difficult. They make them unlock boxes in order to get dinner. These things are amazing. So you look at the different species that are apex intelligence and you figure, meh. Humans, we're just at the end of one of those trees.
Yeah.
So that's why in Galaxy Quest, they all are squid-like.
And when you consider kind of the chain of accidents that's necessary, I mean, if the dinosaurs were never wiped out, then the mammals never would have risen.
Right, and this room would be way too small for a bunch of intelligent dinosaurs.
Yeah. And if you take it from
there's no guarantee that any evolutionary change is going to generate intelligence that we would recognize as intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
That's also sort of an accident.
If you look at all the things that had to happen to the Earth to allow humans to exist here, you realize that it's a 1 in a billion chance that we actually exist on the planet. But when you have a billion planets, then one of them could very possibly have it. So it's like the monkeys writing Shakespeare. If you keep on doing it, somebody's going to come up with it.
If you look at an ant farm, it looks pretty intelligent, even though not one individual is the intelligent one.
So squid, how do you know that? Squid are smart?
Squid are smart.
That's, yeah, come
Octopus
on.
Octopus make
I'm
houses.
I'm not kidding.
Gardens, right?
Yeah.
Well, exactly.
Amazing.
In the shade.
Amazing. The things you learn on the science forum. Don in Mansfield, Connecticut. Don.
Hello, everybody, today.
Yeah, I'm okay. How are you?
My question is about space and black holes. I've always had this. I've had an argument with a few people about this. If you're in near a black hole, and I don't know the theory behind light traveling through space, but my quick question is: if you can take a star and put a light switch on it, put it outside the event horizon. Supposedly, light is the fastest thing as far as we know, and you can turn on that light switch. That you'd see the light. You're off in a distance. You'd see the light coming from the star. If you move the star within the event horizon and you turn on the light switch, the star back on, does the light come out of the black hole or does it not?
The short answer is no, it does not.
That's why they call it the event horizon.
And the reason
this is where I run into a problem.
Okay.
Is if light is the fastest thing, then what is keeping, something has to be pulling the light back or the photons or whatever it is, because I don't really understand it, but something has to be pulling light back faster than light speed in order to keep it in there. Isn't that something that's always bothers me? I can never figure that part out.
That's right. And that thing is gravity.
Lots of it.
Lots of it. Exactly.
Yeah. That the gravity has distorted space enough that the straight line that light is traveling is curved back into the black hole.
So it's not actually pulling it straight back. Flowing the photons to a point where they can't come out.
That's
well,
right.
If you decrease a photon below the speed of light, it's no longer light. Because only runs at one speed.
So gravity can flow light?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it does all the time.
In fact, the what made Einstein famous was his prediction that light would be bent by the light from a star would be bent by the gravity of the sun, and that was proved in, when was that? 1918.
Yeah.
Right after the First World War. So that was the proof that gravity affected light. So there's no doubt about that.
But it's not affecting the photons. Do photons have mass?
Well, that's the part I was going to say. We all read in our high school textbooks, if we were reading, that photons are massless.
Right.
That they're only pure energy that are in discrete packets. But there's more and more evidence that they do have mass, but that mass might be so small that's why it's affected. Because there's two forms of thought. They're massless, and yet gravity can affect them, which doesn't really...
Well, it does if you follow what Jim says, and that it's actually warping, putting a bowling ball in a blanket, and you're warping space itself.
Well, there are two ways to get around that. One is saying that the light's following a straight line, mm-hmm. but that straight line is curved by gravity.
Right.
Okay. The other is that with the equivalence of mass and energy, the photons definitely have energy, And since energy and mass are
equivalent,
E equals mc squared.
That energy is what's being affected by the gravity,
but attenuated in some way. That there's some kind of, because it's more energy than anything else,
right,
it's attenuated its reaction to gravity. Because if you look at the typical gravity equations in books, they all have mass elements in them.
And there's also the part of it that goes that we've now been able to slow light down to below 30 miles an hour by simply running
not
it
in
through,
a vacuum, though.
Through a vacuum,
right,
through a major vacuum.
This has been a
major vacuum?
Yeah,
we can slow it to 30 in a vacuum?
Well, I believe what happened, what they did is they removed all the particles from within the container, shot a light through it, and they were able to slow it down enormously.
I thought it was because it was in something else.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that.
Well, it will
slow
down that way, too,
yeah,
but I'll check on that. I'll take
that
for homework.
Homework.
This has been an interesting program. Very different than usual.
Yes.
Clorox to space-time continuum.
Squids.
It's hint from Heloise number two.
And I'll be looking up the octopus IQ test right after the show.
You can take it, too.
I'll fail. Support comes from the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org, the Lake George Land Conservancy, Fulton Landing, New York, protecting the land that protects the lake, offering more than 32 miles of trails for hiking, birding, and outdoor exploration. HikeLakeGeorge.org. And watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Thanks again to Barbara, Ed, and Jim for being here. Thanks to you for listening and for all the great calls and emails today. Zach Malloy, our engineer, well done, sir. Deb Malik took your calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, this is great. We welcome back Anissa Wahid of Tara Kitchen for what is sure to be a fantastic Food Friday. She is a great guest with great food. Right now, though, stand by for news.